Hi, I'm Tom Flynn.
And I'm Lori Feathers.
And welcome to Lost in Redonda. Hey, Lori, how are you doing today?
Tom, I'm doing well. We've got a guest today.
We do. Joining us today in our line of guest hosts, we have Spencer Ruckte of Third Place Books hanging out with us. Hey, Spencer, how are you doing?
I am doing so well. Hello, Tom. Hello, Lori. Good to see you both.
Welcome, Spencer. We're excited to talk to you today. Maybe it would be good if you would tell us a little bit about your bookstore. And then I also want to ask you about a cool literary prize that you've just been, responsible for getting off the ground.
Oh my God. I would love to tell you both about my bookstore and about the literary prize that Lori's referring to called the Cercador Prize. I'll start with my bookstore. I've been working for Third Place Books here in Seattle, Washington since 2021. So I came in as the events manager for the store in the middle of the pandemic. We were only hosting virtual events, basically kind of rebuilt the program so we could start hosting authors in the store again. I've been a bookseller for 7 years now, or let's see, am I doing that math correctly? Yeah, 7 years, and have just never quite been able to get away from it. I've worked at several different stores, including Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, as well as Broadway Books in Portland. Third Place Books is certainly the biggest store I've ever had the fortune of working for. We have three locations in Seattle, and I help schedule events for all three stores. It's a giant, you know, general interest store. Each neighborhood store is very distinct from one another and its audience and the customers it attracts. Like, you'll see things on the bestseller list at our Ravenna neighborhood store that, you know, maybe we've sold two copies of here at our flagship store in Lake Forest Park. So it's a really interesting dynamic between the three stores. Each, you know, I'm always kind of picking and choosing authors based on like which neighborhood audience I think will work best. I know we actually recently hosted one of your past guests, Robin McLean, at our Ravenna store this last year. And she was wonderful. But again, it's like kind of the audience interested in like small press literature, you know, experimental literature, gnarlier literature. Like, we have to kind of divvy those authors up in a special way. As far as the Cercador Prize goes, yeah, this year, my dear friend and I, Justin Walls, started a prize for literature and translation called the Cercador Prize. It is a prize run entirely by booksellers, the first of its kind. We have 10 finalists that we announced in September, and then we announced the winner of those 10 finalists receives a $1,000 prize conferred entirely to the translator. It was a very fun project this first year. We're going into our second year and kind of, you know, developing ideas for what we want kind of the theme to be, what, you know, new booksellers we want to bring into the committee. Our winner this year was of Cattle and Men by the Brazilian writer Ana Paula Maia, which was translated by Zoe Perry. Just a wonderful, tight, haunting novel about labor and agricultural trade in Brazil that's very similar to, you know, what we might see here in the United States. It's about a slaughterhouse worker named Edgar Wilson, and it's a wonderful short book. I won't get too much into it because we have Swiss Germans to talk about today. But yeah, do you want me to talk a little bit about Robert Walser, my relationship with him?
Sure, but I just wanted to also say that Of Cattle and Men is a fantastic book. I mean, it's a very strange book to describe as wonderful, or for me to say that I love, because so brutal.
It's a really brutal book. Yeah,
it's like you feel like the hard glare of the sun throughout the entire book. Yeah. At no moment are you not in some way being interrogated by it, but it's really impressive. And I think the fact that it is so short and is so tight really just emphasizes that, and frankly allows you to get through it. I don't know if I could have done 250 pages of that particular novel.
I will say one of the things, if I may, that I was surprised about during our, you know, finalist deliberation, each committee member, so there are five of us, is responsible for reading all 10 titles on the finalist list and coming up with kind of a unanimous winner of those 10 titles. And one of the things that I was surprised by, that maybe I shouldn't have been, is that as booksellers, many of the booksellers on the committee were discussing the finalists in terms of, how we would talk to customers about these books in the store, how we would like communicate the importance or kind of like the bizarreness of these, the strangeness of some of these titles to a reader who might not be familiar with translated literature, which is, in my mind, kind of the goal of the prize altogether, is to make, you know, increase the audience for translated literature, you know, make sure readers are aware that, you know, of the international scene for literature, also raise awareness for the work of translators. Bruna at the National Book Awards, who translated Daniel Gardel's The Words That Remain, she, in her speech when that book won, said something along the lines of, like, you know, translators are not fairies working in the dark, which is absolutely true. And it's so that's why we decided from Justin and I decided from the get-go that we wanted to make sure this prize was acknowledging the works of translator, the work of translators, whose work are often obscured and in the dark, often like booksellers as well. And that we wanted this money to go, you know, to the translator as opposed to the publisher, to the author, because we felt like just that gesture was important to us.
That's fantastic. So happy that this prize is here. And just so we can hit something near and dear to my heart, why don't you mention the publisher of that title? And a pretty damn good little publisher there that's doing such great work right now.
Yeah. And that publisher is Charco Press. They're based out of the UK in Scotland. They are, my God, they really hit the spot for me. I think 9 times out of 10, you know, when I'm able to read their books look beautiful. They have thematic cover designs, so you can recognize a Charco Press book on the shelf immediately. They have great distribution as well in the US, so it's easy to obtain those titles. They've had, you know, great success with novels by like Arianne Horowitz, who wrote Feeble Minded. Oh, and I should mention that Charco Press exclusively publishes Latin American literature, I believe. And so there's also kind of a theme there as well. And it narrows the field, but also allows them to specialize. And so you have a lot of like interested bookseller. If your main interest in translated literature is Latin American literature, you can go to Charco Press, and you know that, you know, anything that you pick off their title is gonna be your speed.
Yeah, they're really doing good work for a little literary prize that I started here in the U.S. and Canada. Their submission this year for 2023 is Two Sherpas. So I don't know if you guys are familiar with that title.
That's a really good, I really like that book a lot.
Yeah. So they are doing great work. We had Claudio Pinheiro zoom in for a book club meeting at the store.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, with Carolina Orloff, the woman that runs and is the brains behind the whole press. And she was doing the translation for us as we were having the book club discussion. So that was really cool. So, well, congratulations on the prize, Spencer.
Thank
I'm so glad that's here, and good luck. And I just hope it keeps going for the next 100 years.
Yeah, for many more years to come until one of us dies. And even then, we'll find an inheritor. It'll be great.
Yeah, you should make sure you have your seconds lined up. The person has to, no matter what, come hell or high water. And then you just casually disappear and leave them to take over running it.
That's right. That's what a lot of like, you know, CEOs seem to do anyway. So I just have to like adopt the CEO mindset.
That part of the mindset, not the grind set, not that approach. No, the make sure there's someone there to take on all the work. Actually, that's a really nice way to segue into the Tanners and characters who, some of whom have absolutely no inclination to do anything for more than a few weeks at a time. But so you had us read Robert Walzer's The Tanners from New Directions, translated by Susan Bernofsky. I hadn't read any Walzer before this. I'm not sure, Lori, if you have or not.
Yes, I'd read The Tanners once before, maybe 9-10 years ago.
Okay. But why don't you say a little bit about it and maybe also, you know, and get into a little bit why, I guess, also in keeping with the approach of the committee for the Cercador, maybe give us the bookseller pitch around this one too.
Oh, absolutely. So Robert Walser's The Tanners, a very important novel to me. And first of all, I want to say, you know, I want to thank the two of you for giving me the opportunity to file through old books on my shelf. And I don't often have the opportunity to reread books that I love. So this was a really fantastic exercise. I'm a huge Robert Walser fan. The Tanners was the first book I read of his. You know, I have two small shelves dedicated to his work alone. So I'm a bit of a completist. The Tanners is about, I would say, you know, to give the basic pitch, it's about a 20-something narrator trying to find his way in the world. And a lot of that kind of extends through labor and jobs, like jobs he picks up, as well as his kind of distaste for that work or his love of that work. And when I found or first discovered Robert Walser, I didn't know anything about him, but I was it was about probably 5 years ago, 2018, I was on my first trip to New York ever. So I was, you know, kind of, I was being bombed, but I'm from Southeast Idaho. So, you know, at the time, big cities still kind of like frightened me. I just moved to Boston and I was doing a bookstore tour, and I went to Greenlight Bookstore and picked up The Tanners off the shelf, based basically on the colophon alone. It was published by New Directions, and I knew I loved those books. And also, I had never heard of this book. I didn't, and it's often difficult as a bookseller to find books that you're unfamiliar with. So that was instantly kind of attractive to me. And then, of course, there's an introduction by W.G. Zabald in this edition, and that was also immediately attractive to me. And I thought, well, if Zabald likes it, then I'm sure I'll love it too. So I picked it up in the store, and I read the opening passage of the book proper, which starts with Simon Tanner, the narrator, trying to get a job at a bookstore, which was applicable to me, of course, as someone who worked at a bookstore. And he starts off this long speech by saying, he goes on many monologues throughout the novel, but this one's one of my favorites. He says, "I want to become a bookseller," said the youthful novice. "I yearn to become one, and I don't know what might prevent me from carrying out my intentions. I've always imagined the trade in books must be an enchanting activity, and I cannot understand why I should still be forced to pine away outside of this fine, lovely occupation." And he goes on talking to the proprietor of this bookstore for another page until he convinces the bookseller to give him a job. Well, mere pages later, a week later, in the time span of the novel, he marches back into the store, and he basically demands his wages and says, "I'm going to quit." He says, "During the past week, I've come to realize that the entire book trade is nothing less than ghastly if it must entail standing at one's desk from early morning till late at night while out of doors the gentlest winter sun is gleaming." And then he complains about the work of being a bookseller for two more pages, and this really sets the tone for the rest of the novel, where you have Simon Tanner kind of floating in and out of work, which is also kind of reminiscent of the author's biography as well. You know, took on many positions, during the course of his life in many different trades, in addition to being a writer.
Spencer, have you used either of these speeches by Simon Tanner in procuring bookselling jobs or leaving bookselling jobs?
You know, I've thought about it, actually. I once thought about copying, and there's a period, like especially during the pandemic, where I was out of work and I was living in Portland, and I was applying for jobs at Powell's and Broadway Books to basically no success. I was just trying to get part-time work. And I actually typed out some of the lines from these first pages about, you know, the wonder of bookselling. And I was going to like adapt it and see if I could do something with it. I didn't have the guts to actually send it because it seemed, you know, way too false. And Susan Bernofsky does a wonderful job translating this. I mean, this novel is from, let me double check. I almost said 1901, but I don't think that's correct. 1907. It's also one of Robert Walser's first novels, probably his second publication, aside from a collection of like vignettes and essays that he published. But Susan Bernofsky does a really wonderful job of like modernizing that language just a little bit, like enough that it feels, still feels like a novel published in 1907. But there's like, if I copy and pasted that paragraph into a cover letter applying for a bookstore position, someone might just think I was an eccentric.
Or someone might recognize it and be like, this guy's brilliant. Knows literature. Yeah, because The Tanners is one of my favorite books too.
Or they might read it and be and know what comes next from
yes, exactly.
And be really concerned
about
it.
A week later.
I mean, it'd be a great way to get an interview, maybe not the best way to secure the job.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I do have to confess, you know, this is, it's been 5 years, you know, since I've read this book, and it is not the book that I remember it being. And so I think that, you know, I figure that's also part of like the healthy discussion of reading and rereading books you love. But I remember being so enamored by this book and looking at Simon Tanner as, you know, definitely not a template to follow, but at least it was kind of like, to me when I was younger, a thinking person's exercise in like finding your way and how to be a person in the world in kind of like a more eccentric, wayward sense. You know, in high school, I was reading, you know, lots of beat poetry and wanted to be Kerouac like a lot of young white men in Southeast Idaho. But this was kind of like it entered into a, oh, lights just turned off. 1 second. Oh, the whole power to the bookstore's power just shut off. And now there are lights flashing.
It might be a fire alarm. Do you need to get up and go?
I don't think so. I can keep going. Can you actually see me? Oh, you probably can't even see me because it's so dark in here.
We can hear you, but we cannot see. We can occasionally see the flickering of the light.
That's so weird. Oh my God. Here, maybe if I turn this around. Can you hear the siren going off?
Yes. That's why I'm thinking it's a fire alarm.
I'll be back. All right. Thanks.
Okay. So Spencer, all right, tell we're us. All good. Okay.
We'll leave some of that excitement in there.
You know what's funny is we actually had someone pulled the fire alarm 2 Fridays ago. We were hosting Allie Hazelwood at the store. So we had like a huge sold out event. Someone pulled a fire alarm in the middle of the event. We weren't about to evacuate like, you know, 300 people. So we just told everyone like, stay seated. We finally got the alarm to turn off. Firefighters showed up. You know, it was like a whole thing as like this panel of romance authors was trying to talk and do their thing. And I got up on stage and told everyone, you know, everything is fine. Like the fire department assures us. Someone just, you know, some kid pulled the fire alarm on a Friday night. It just, you know, bound to happen eventually. And then I said, but if any of you want to meet a firefighter tonight. And they cracked up. Oh, it's so great. And that's how you host romance events. Bring a bunch of firefighters in.
That might be the title of this episode, how to host a romance.
Or do you want to meet a fireman?
Or do you want to meet a fireman? Yeah.
Okay, so where do we need to pick up again here?
And so you were talking about rereading it after 5 years and how things change.
And I think what's funny is that because this was the first novel by Robert Walser I'd read, I realized that everything I read after, and just for context, for those who aren't familiar with his work translated into English, a lot of it is translated by either Tom Whalen or Susan Brunofsky across many different books and collections. But Robert Walser is actually not most famous for his novels. He's most famous for these very short prose pieces, some might call them vignettes, that are mostly collected in these New York Review of Book editions. If someone out there is looking to start with one, I would say the most famous collection, or the collection that contains some of his more famous, like well-known pieces, is called Girlfriends, Ghosts, and Other Stories, which is kind of a ridiculous title, but you know, some of his more quotable pieces are like A Little Ramble, and Remember This, and one that actually Zabald talks about in his introduction to The Tanners is called Ash, Needle, Pencil, and Match. And in these vignettes, he's often talking about, it's kind of like the best work that you find in The Tanners at a sentence level and at an observation level. You have Robert Walser like observing people in the city, talking about the natural world, talking about joys and delights for the most part. Like he can be a very grumpy and cantankerous writer, but overall, like he really delights in the world and being alive and loves that. And it's kind of like, I see him as like kind of on the opposite side of this German spectrum to like Thomas Bernhard, who's very scathing and dark and, you know, always pointing a finger at someone. Whereas like Robert Walser can take, you know, something like pencil scraping or ash, and he gives it life and he gives it personality, and he's able to, you know, find everything in, you know, in a very small piece of minutia. There's this line in A Little Ramble that's just about, it's a very short, you know, one page piece just about Robert Walser, like walking through the mountains, enjoying the countryside, just talking about the little things he comes upon. And the last few lines are, "I encountered a few carts, otherwise nothing, and I had seen some children on the country lane. We don't need to see anything out of the ordinary. We already see so much." And I remember, you know, when I was a young bookseller in Boston, reading that line on the subway platform and like missing home, you know, missing the mountains, missing kind of the Northwest countryside, and just like it just hit me like a brick wall, that those few lines. So I think The Tanners, it's not a good introduction to Robert Walser, certainly, but it is a really interesting character study. You have, you know, Simon Tanner and his many siblings are, you know, kind of are disparate parts of the world, disparate places in their lives, and in various places of like financial and, you know, job career security, I guess you can say. And then you have Simon Tanner kind of floating in between all of these siblings. Like, he doesn't have a defined career. He doesn't really have a defined lifestyle. He writes, but he's mostly just floating and observing. And some of the strongest pieces of the book are like these profound observations he has about human life.
This is something that came up in the first season of the of our podcast, specifically the Maria's title, Man of Feeling.
Oh, huh.
Laurie hadn't read before, but my memory of it was how much I adored it. And then on the reread, maybe I'm in a different place in my life. Maybe I just read it differently, but it did not hit me in anywhere near the same way. But similarly, I think that your first introduction to an author, no matter where you land on it on a subsequent reread, often turns into the gateway. I mean, it's the lens through which you see all their subsequent work. And it's the way that you can kind of argue for how to approach an author's work. For like Haruki Murakami, Norwegian Wood was the first one I read. And so I always felt that Norwegian Wood, I got into arguments actually with another bookseller. He felt that Hard-Boiled Wonderland and The End of the World was the perfect way to get into Murakami. I felt as Norwegian Wood, the answer is they both are.
Well, right. It happens all the time. You think, you know, someone asks you, well, what's the best way to get into, you know, such and such author? And you're like, well, it's this novel because that's the one I read. And I can't imagine any other experience that, you know, it's hard to imagine another experience or portal through to an author. And I completely agree with that. But yeah, because I read, you know, The Tanners is probably not my favorite. It might not even be my favorite Robert Walser novel, but it is the first one that I read and the one that like cracked open the world for me.
Yeah, it kind of has that like urtext feel to it, right?
So, Spencer, you said that this is a book about character and character development. Talk to us a little bit about what you think Walser is doing here. You know, it's certainly a coming of age novel, but it's not particularly plot heavy.
No.
So how would you explain this novel to someone?
Yeah, I think, you know, foremost, I think it's easy probably to conflate Robert Walser, the author, with, you know, Simon Tanner, the character, because this is an early novel, even in 1907, you know, the temptation, I think, to write of oneself was there. And I think it's easy to kind of assume that Robert Walser was like Simon Tanner, was kind of this like waifish, eccentric, idling, flaneur, who didn't really, you know, didn't care about, was always looking for work, but refused to hold a job for longer than, you know, a week or two if it displeased him. But in truth, you know, Robert Walser was extraordinarily disciplined as a writer. You know, he was one of eight children. He came from a, you know, middle-class family. Carl, his brother, much like Klaus in the novel, his brother Carl Walser, was an artist, and you can actually see some of his work in one of my favorite books of Robert Walser ephemera, I'll call it, called Looking at Pictures. It's this little book that New Directions published, a little hardcover that collects a lot of Robert Walser's like writing on artwork, and then it'll actually display the art kind of on a facing page. it's hard to describe because I don't know much about book design, but it's like very unique. It's probably one of the most beautiful books that I own. And you see some of Karl Walzer's artwork in there. But anyway, so there are a lot of autobiographical elements to this book, but it's also, you know, there's admittedly Simon Tanner doesn't necessarily change that much by the end. There's not a lot of traditional character development in the way that we think of it or that, you know, one might read about in an MFA course. But you are kind of getting, I think, throughout, like, more and more an enhanced, like, Simon Tanner becomes grounded more and more. He has these interactions with his siblings that, you know, don't always go so well. He, you know, comes across, for example, a dead body in the woods, and it deeply affects him. You know, he's experiencing kind of these bizarre, almost outlandish portions of life that don't necessarily make sense from a normal novel standpoint. But I think Simon becomes more grounded by the end of the novel. And that's kind of where the development comes from.
Let's talk a little bit about Simon's intentions or his agency, because he has a very roundabout way of, I think, getting what he wants. Whether it's a job, as we discussed with the book selling, he's a little bit self-denigrating, you know, like, I don't know why you would hire me, except that I know that this is always what I wanted to do, and I will be like the best employee ever, but I really don't have any qualifications. Oh, and you say, ask, do I have any recommendations? Well, no, and I'm rather kind of offended that you would even ask for a recommendation from someone who knows me. And then when he goes to obtain his first or his apartment in the boarding house with Frau Clara, he kind of the same way, this is wonderful, and I could never dream of living somewhere this beautiful. I have no money, so of course, you know, I can just feel, you know, sorry for myself that I'll never be able to live here, you know. And then she's like, oh, I don't really care about the money, please move in. So he seems to like ingratiate himself with people and get what he wants, but in this very roundabout, indirect way.
Yeah, and he's very hot-headed in a way. Robert Walzer's characters are very often, including in one of his more famous novels, like Jacob von Guten, they're often clerks and servants, and that's kind of a theme you find in a lot of the author's work. Is you have these characters who are like eager, not just eager, but like their life's mission, their life's passion is to serve other people, to provide good service. And it's interesting to see that on, I guess it kind of ends up informing like Simon Tanner's, like, he wants to please people. He wants to kind of enter into the like course of a career as quickly and as kind of aggressively as possible. But it will also, if it doesn't, you know, if he finds that the work is invaluable, like, he'll turn his back and leave. But his definition of what that work is and what is invaluable is unique, like, a little, it just contributes to his hot-headedness.
But you wouldn't necessarily say that he's just like falling into these things, right?
No, he seems to seek them out. Yeah, he recognizes that he needs, you know, one needs to work in order to get money. There's a point in the novel when Simon Tanner talks about how, you know, he's been searching for work on and off, and he's had kind of the freedom to pick and choose what he wants to do for, you know, in terms of labor. And he mentions in kind of a side note that he's been living off like an inheritance given to him by his parents. And now he no longer has that. So now he has to, you know, buckle down and really find long-term work, or kind of be able to find people who are kind and generous enough to give him a home, give him a food and a, you know, a roof over his head.
That said, I do feel like there are aspects to his character that very much feel like he's just in the wind. I mean, that his arguments can shift from one interaction to the next. And a lot of the work that he engages in, and a lot of the, I mean, he moves around a lot. So from town to town, city to city, forest to forest, there is almost a examination of the society of the time taking place there too, because he's engaging with all levels of that society, from folks who are day laborers to, I mean, he works as basically the manservant for a wealthy mm-hmm. woman and her invalid child. And in that situation, he doesn't quit. He just makes himself such a nuisance that eventually she shows him the door. And that's mm-hmm. clearly his goal. But prior to that, he spent a lot of time thinking about how much he enjoyed being castigated for doing something wrong, or what it means when the master punishes the servant. Mm-hmm. And I mean, so there is a lot of digging in a way that I think Simon might be doing. But I think that's also against the backdrop of very much desiring love and care. The novel kind of ends with someone basically just accepting him, taking him in. And this is a novel in which I would guess a third of it is spoken by Simon in these very long, often diatribes, to be, I guess, generous.
Yeah.
But it does not end. He does not get the final word of the novel. And in an earlier point, Clara, who you mentioned, falls in love with, is it Casper that's the painter?
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. With his brother Casper, the painter, which is fine. And he has a long conversation about love and loving with Clara. But then when he sees his friend Rosa, she asks after Casper. And that, I think at the chapter like break at that point is Simon realizing, oh, she's in love with him too. And then the chapter ends. There are a lot of those. I mean, on the craft level, Walzer does a very good job of having these, you know, lush descriptions of countryside and these long declarations of thought and meditation on labor or love or what have you. And then there will just be a very short paragraph of an intrusion of reality into whatever it is that Simon has been thinking about. I'm also thinking about when he's living with his sister Hedwig and they have this very long conversation thinking about very high-minded things. And then that portion ends when the wife of the school teacher from the town over knocks at the door because her husband just beat the hell out of her and they take care of her. And then there's the shift. So like reality punches its way into Simon's life in ways that he probably isn't accounting for and is in some ways, I think, maybe working against.
Yeah. And it's very sober, like that scene you just mentioned about, you know, Simon and Hedwig having this conversation. And then suddenly there's a knock on the door. And that in that portion of the chapter, you know, lasts maybe two or three sentences after, you know, this, you know, many, many pages of conversation. Yeah, it's very chilling the way he does this, I think, and how he's, you know, it shows, I think, authorial intent, the author's ability to, like, the author knows that what we are getting of Simon Tanner are more or less ramblings, some of which are, you know, with their small nuggets kind of buried into these ramblings, but also the author is aware that life is not just a thinking person's game. There's also these, you know, alarming violence that occurs. There's reality intrudes. There's money at stake. There's you know, one's career and life at stake in many of these situations that Simon Tanner just kind of like, you know, attempting to like blow through life. But I think it's one of the elements of this novel that I really enjoy.
Reading this, I couldn't help making comparisons to one of my very favorite novels of all time, Thomas Mann's Buddenbrooks. Mm-hmm. And that book is titled Decline of a Family. It's the subtitle of it, basically. And it's about the Buddenbrook clan, you know, siblings, parents, grandparents. And this is going to be very, very generalized morsel to take away from that great novel. But I get the feeling that Thomas Mann is articulating a German idea through that novel that if everyone in the Buddenbrooks clan had just kind of maintained some type of professional occupation, much like the older brother Klaus in the Tanners, then the family wouldn't be going to hell like it is. And it just like starts sliding in Buddenbrooks until like it's a dissipated kind of state. So here we've got Klaus, who's a career man. I forget, is he in government service? He's got a very good position, I know.
He's an academic, I think.
Okay. But, you know, he's a serious guy and he's got a career. And then he's got, you know, Simon, who's flitting to and fro, and Casper, who's trying to be a landscape artist, painter. And when Klaus is given the opportunity to talk, when Simon shuts up long enough, you know, you hear things about, like, I just want you guys to get real job, settle down, get your act together. The kind of things I think that you would find older brothers saying, mm-hmm. you know, even today. I don't know, Spencer, and it's probably an unfair question, whether Thomas Mann and Robert Walser might have been in dialogue in some either actual way through these books or just some way through myself as a reader of their books. But what do you think is going on here with, like, Germany at the time that this novel is taking place, and talking about career aspirations and ambition and versus kind of a more decadent, I don't know, breezing your way through life and not having a clear path or clear goals or direction?
Yeah, I sincerely wish I knew more about what was happening in Germany, you know, during this period. I know that, you know, Buddenbrooks was published, you know, probably at the, maybe a few years before the Tanners.
I think that's so right.
It was certainly in the, probably dialogue with, you know, that Robert Walser's work as he started publishing, you know, that would have been, you know, would have been published and out in the world. I know that, like, Kafka very much, you know, looked up to Robert Walser as kind of an influence on his early work, especially as, like, a miniaturist. And I would probably, yeah, I'd have to read Susan Bernofsky's biography of Robert Walser again to kind of to tell you more about that. But that's another book I'll shout out, is that just recently, the translator of this book, Susan Bernofsky, wrote a biography of Robert Walser for Yale University Press that was just, you know, stunning. And it was one of the first kind of, like, and it's one of the first, I think, English language biographies of Robert Walser, and certainly the only one that's in print. So if you're interested in this, you know, I'd also highly recommend Susan's work on the topic too.
I do think we could also pull in, though, though I'm not sure you've read it, Spencer, Imperium by Christian Kracht, which is contemporary, but is set in a similar time frame and is in a similar, like, milieu of Germany at the turn of the 20th century and the pressures within the society at the time, the state exerting greater control, but new ideas and new ideas of how to be a person, and rejection of what is supposed to be a lifestyle, your life as you move along. I mean, I think that is certainly in the air. It's interesting. Like, the more I think about it, the more we talk about it, the more I get a feeling that, and we should read a little bit, like, at least one of his landscape descriptions. He's a gorgeous prose writer.
Oh, yeah.
When he wants to be. Like, he just, it makes you feel like the forests in Switzerland and Germany are the most beautiful, like, idyllic spaces on the planet. But I think he's also really digging into the society of his time, that there's this tension between there's a certain dreamlike quality to how Simon moves around and how he talks and the people he speaks with. And not, I don't mean that in a surreal sense. It just sort of has that sort of that gauzy veiled feeling to it, where the light's just a little different. But when he wants to shift gears and really kind of dig into social interactions, he can do that too. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is part of what he's accomplishing with Simon moving from point to point, is it gives him a vehicle to do all that, to really kind of talk about and dig into all of that.
Yeah, I always joke that Robert Walser is, like, a true Pacific Northwest writer because he loves hiking and is enamored by biology and landscape. You know, there's, like, something of, like, Barry Lopez in his appreciations for nature. That's probably unfair. But there is, but yeah, you read him and you also feel like you are reading, you know, a little bit of, like, Alexander von Humboldt or Heinrich von Kleist as well, two Vons in there. But like, you know, Robert Walser was a was an amateur naturalist as well as a writer. And often you kind of, you know, you don't realize this, but when he's, you know, he in the Tanners, he writes about, you know, hiking through mountains, like just to get to the next city. Like he was hiking. There's another wonderful book called Walks with Walser by Carl Seelig that New Directions also published. And it's the memoirs of Carl Seelig talking about his relationship with Walser. And Carl Seelig is kind of like the Max Brod. Let's see, how do I phrase this? Max Brod is to Kafka as Carl Seelig is to Robert Walser. So Carl Seelig was responsible for a lot of Walser's posthumous work being published for kind of keeping him in the literary domain as time went on. And Carl Seelig writes about how, you know, he would go on these walks with his friend Robert Walser, and they would, and they were very lengthy walks, and they weren't just like, you know, going on an open country road, you know, they were really hiking. And so it comes from that, I think a lot of that, you know, that appreciation of nature just comes from a desire at the time to supplant oneself, to use walking as like a thinking mechanism, which is something we still see a little bit of today. You know, you have, you know, 5 or 6 books any given year on the market about like the pleasures of being a flaneur. You know, it's still something we talk about a lot today, but, you know, it's also one of my favorite things about Robert Walser's talk, his, when he just talks about walking and what he sees on those walks.
Should we read a passage? Do one of you guys have something set aside that we could share with the listeners that kind of demonstrates the beauty of this?
Yeah.
Since Rivia one too, but I've got one right here. Oh, yeah. It's early in the novel, page 67. And this is Simon walking with Casper. And they're walking back to Clara's house in the woods. The setting sun blazed in their windows, turning them into radiant eyes, gazing fixedly, beautifully into the distance. Down below lay the city, spread out broad and luxuriant upon the plain like a glittering, twinkling carpet. The evening bells, which are always different from morning bells, were ringing far below. The lake lay, its outlines indistinct, in its delicate, ineffable form at the foot of the city, the mountain and all the gardens. Not many lights were sparkling yet, but those whose glow could be seen were burning with a splendid, unfamiliar keenness. People were now walking and hastening down below in all the crooked, hidden streets. You couldn't see them, but you knew they were there.
Yeah, that's lovely.
But you knew they were there. Just lands the plane so perfectly. Like, it's just such a great, yeah, so evocative, and just such a great way to like really connect you with something that, an experience that almost everyone's had. You always know there are people moving around somewhere in some distance that you're looking at. You might not be able to see them, but there's a comfort or a sureness in the world and knowing that other people are moving around.
Should we talk a little bit about sense of humor? I think there's a real sense of humor in this book.
Oh, he's hilarious. Yeah, he's very funny.
But it's not something that like knocks you over the head.
Yeah.
It's something about how ardent Simon is, overly so, you know, like a youthful person often is. The whole relationship with Clara and her husband is really ridiculous in a lot of ways. I don't know. What, tell us about it, Spencer, from your perspective.
Yeah, it's Simon Tanner, I think, is such an interesting character, because I think nowadays if a character like Simon was written, it would be written in kind of a, you know, everything is a little bit satirical. Like, we're making fun of Simon because he is such a strong personality, and he is often wrong, and he is often making these like grand statements and making these grand gestures that are, you know, quite frankly, very obnoxious. And so he would be played for laughs in that way, in a way that Robert Walser, you know, it was probably not common to this time anyways, but Robert Walser does not do that. You know, there are these grand gestures that are obviously ridiculous, and these grand statements he makes that are, you know, I think to the reader, very obviously incorrect, but he's also much more complex than that. You know, it's not always satirical. Sometimes these, you know, you have humor buried in here, and yeah, it's not like hit you over the head kind of slapstick humor, but, you know, just to go back to the to what I think is, you know, one of the funniest passages in the book, which is, you know, those opening pages when Simon Tanner, professes how much he, you know, wants to work in a bookstore, and pages later comes back and says, basically just turns everything he said in the previous pages on its head and says, no, actually, I've discovered that, you know, my experience, you know, as a bookseller is the exact opposite of what I wanted. You know, you are mistaken if you believe that a young man's back exists in order to be hunched is one of my favorite lines there. Talking about, you know, the work of standing at a desk that's way too tiny for your body. And so I think it's just the neurotic kind of juxtaposition that, you know, Simon Tanner embodies all thoughts. He doesn't have, you know, he doesn't really stand on stable ground, you know, ethically or otherwise.
But there's something about him too, and this is kind of funny, in that he quits these jobs with these grand pronouncements, basically denigrating the professions from which he's
altogether. Yes.
But then like the bosses that he's addressing are like, this is, you know, extraordinary that you're talking to me like that, like this, but I'm interested. So please just tell me more. It's really, that's some of the funniest segments, I think, too, when these people are just having this young kid tear into them about how despicable their job was and didn't live up to any of his expectations. Mm-hmm. And it's the professions that these people have dedicated their lives to. And they just are like, oh, okay. You know, almost like incredulous. They can't believe someone that this, especially someone this young, is like talking to them about it. And they're just are kind of recoiling because it's insulting, but at the same time they're kind of mesmerized because it's really just astounding that he's talking to them like that.
There are also moments in some of the longer speeches, and not just by Simon, this happens to both Klaus and Hedwig at least a couple times, maybe even Clara, where they're making these grand pronouncements and they're winding themselves up more and more and getting like more and more excited and moving further and further away from their starting point. And then you'll see a break where they go, wait, don't make that face. That's not, you know, that's not what I meant at all. And they realize that they've just contradicted themselves, or the person they're speaking to suddenly exists again. They've noticed that they're actually talking to someone, not just like pronouncing to the universe their grand idea. And so this like this sudden shift that he does, where they're very startled that all of a sudden this other person has a thought process, and it jolts them out of it. It's fun, and having been that person on more than a few occasions, I enjoyed that, those interactions. Balzer just does have a very good eye for how people can engage with each other, and like how they can cut each other really deeply without intention, and it seems often without intention, and also how they can, you know, express concern as Klaus does, but in a way that completely undercuts everything he's attempting to achieve with his siblings. So we meet all of the Tanner siblings except for one. And the one we only hear about, both randomly in a bar, and then at the end of the novel, towards the end of the novel, when Simon meets this final person who gets the last word, he actually gives a pretty, I mean, it's long, but it's fairly succinct,
like,
description of all of his siblings, of a lot of what has taken place in the novel. It does have, it isn't an epilogue, but it almost serves that function of summing it all up. There are lots of ways in which this novel feels like a serial, just the episodic nature of it. But even within that episodic nature, sometimes it does feel like Simon's a totally different person at the start in a new location than he was in the previous one. But so there's Simon, Hedwig, the only sister, Casper, the artist, Klaus, the academic, and then Emil. Klaus is the oldest, so it's suggested, I believe, that Emil is the second one. Mm-hmm. And when we hear this story about a young man who is very good at life, but then starts to take up with some of the worst people in society, and over time, like, his charm starts to fade, and through deprivation and experience, he ends up going mad. And when this person wraps up their story that Simon's been listening to, he declares, that was actually my brother, Emil. And his father was a flower merchant, right? And starts listing off all these facts to confirm this. And then Emil is mentioned again and that he's now in a madhouse. But initially, as a reader, I feel like you, it sounds like someone's describing Simon. It sounds like someone's describing an aspect of Simon's life we haven't heard yet, with the constant movement, the changeable beliefs, the changing of jobs every 2 to 3 weeks. But instead, it's his older brother whom he defends as not being a ne'er-do-well, but having helped instill a love of nature and a love of the world and a sense of perspective in all of his siblings. I don't know. I'm still thinking about why that character exists within this novel. It puts a spin on things, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily change the trajectory of anything, but it does alter how you're perceiving a lot of what's come before and what comes after.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you say that, because I almost forgot about this, but I remember having the same thought when I was reading those, you know, kind of final passages, as I thought, oh, this person doesn't, you know, is talking about Simon Tanner, but doesn't know he's talking to Simon Tanner. And it turns out there's this other sibling in the mix. And it's an interesting effect, because you have this, I mean, you have this like doppelganger introduced in a way. And it gives Simon a chance to defend his own actions, defend his own course in life, but also realize that there's this kind of alternate path, you know, towards madness in this case, that you know, he himself could have taken. You know, Jan Fosse, in fact, in Septology, does something kind of similar, where he has, you know, he has a doppelganger, or his narrator has a doppelganger who, you know, is consumed by alcoholism. And that's kind of like the diverging point with these two characters. And it gives, you know, the narrator of Septology kind of the ability to look at his own life from an alternate path in a surreal way. In this case, you know, it's very real. There is a literal brother, you know, who he's speaking about and speaking to. But you're right, you know, the two are eerily similar. And I think that, you know, of course, that's very intentional.
And I think too, and maybe I'm going a bit too far in making this inference, but could it be, with this novel being published in the first decade of the new century, that the brother Emil is perhaps someone who couldn't handle the changing times? It's someone that Simon could have been Simon, you know.
Yeah.
But and because Simon says, this unfortunate brother was surely, and I may say so without hesitation, the ideal of a young, beautiful man, and he had talents that would have been better suited to the gallant, charming 18th century than our times, whose demands are so much harder and drier. So it's almost, I think, perhaps a commentary that the world is becoming a place where it's hard. It's hard to live, and you can't perhaps be as sensitive as you once were. You have to kind of paddle or sink, kind of thing.
Yeah, that I think that, in a way, you know, Simon has all these siblings, and kind of, I mentioned earlier, you know, I think the Tanners it's about, you know, a 20 something, you know, man trying to find his way in the world and is exercising all of these different possibilities, you know, and you see it in not only in the jobs that he takes on and the, you know, the attempts at, you know, short lived careers he takes on, but also in the way he drops in on all of his, you know, the lives of his siblings at different parts of the novel. Is it's yet another way to kind of, you know, exercise or experiment with different ways of living, different styles of living, trying to find what he wants his, you know, what he wants the stuff of his life to consist of.
I think that makes a lot of sense and very much tracks with and. The example of Emil kind of puts that into starker relief, right? And to your point, Laurie, I think, yeah, you could perhaps read it as almost a burying of the romantic, right? Of that era of both literature and just sort of like, it's not like it only existed in literature. It was a way of being in the world. And that's a way that's that's going away. I mean, it's really interesting and kind of fun that this novel, which is in so many ways so very light, moves very well, almost despite how much talking. Like, it's the kind of talking that could bog down, but it just sort of trucks along and does really well. But there's this undercurrent to it that you start, you know, lift up the hood a little bit, and there's some warnings maybe existing under that surface. Let me see how many other metaphors I can and for a very random just thought process, and something that occurred to me about halfway through the book, is there a chance that the creators of the show Full House, at least one of whom was a fan of Robert Walser and named the family after Simon and Hedwig and all of them, that, I mean, they are the Tanners in Full House. So I don't know. That just occurred to me.
That's funny. That had not occurred to me.
Is the spelling the same?
Yeah, it's the same spelling of Tanner. I think that Emil would probably be Uncle Jesse, the John Stamos and all of that. And God, that's my headcanon now, is that the creator of Full House was a big Robert Walser head. Like, that would be hilarious. Phenomenal.
Yeah.
I'm sure the creator listens to this podcast, so maybe you'll get a response to that.
So I'm not thinking of in Norway, since we lost that whole country after that episode with Chad. So one of our running jokes now is the episode that Chad posts on it, where we're talking about Jan Sjarstad's book, The Conqueror. We ran a few risks of what we said about Norway, so we'll see what that means. I haven't double checked the downloads for Northern Europe in a little bit.
Spencer, one of the things that we have fun doing is trying to come up with comps to titles. You know,
fascinating.
If you love the Tanners, you'll love. Anything come to your mind?
You know, one thing I was I was actually recently reading Dustin Illingworth, the book critic, wrote. He has this infrequent Substack where he'll just write an essay about something that interests him, post it online. It's nice because it's like, you know, it's not tied to anything around, you know, publication date or media. It's just like something he's interested in. And he wrote recently a Substack post about the life of Robert Walser, whose work I know he loves, but it was mostly centered around Susan Bronowski's biography. And in it, he compared Robert Walser not only to, you know, he was talking about like, in, you know, Walser's influence on Kafka and some of these other like German, you know, absurd, you know, surrealist, absurdist writers, but he also compared some of Walser's like miniature work to the music of Satie, which I thought was really interesting. So there's a music comp there. But, you know, of course, I would say if you like, you know, Zabald is a really good comp. Yeah, I'd have to think of, you know, what's funny is that I think a lot of the, I won't say vignette, but in today's like reading culture, we'd call it like work with a lot of white space attached to it. And so like, which is very popular these days. And a lot of Robert Walser's like vignette work kind of falls into that category, but surprisingly hasn't picked up like, I don't know, mass TikTok appeal. So maybe soon, like we'll have like legions of young, you know, young literary students like flocking to Robert Walser's like miniature work again.
I was kind of thinking Traveler of the Century a little bit, Andre Spielman. It's not a clean comp, but it's kind of occupying a similar, like it occupies a similar space in my head in terms of the landscape, the setting, the time period that it creates. Newman can 100% crush a landscape description if he wants to. The social interactions are in some ways somewhat similar, but yeah, that was the one I came ready this time, Lori. That was the one that occurred to me the most when I was reading it.
And Andres Newman's got a new book coming out next year with Open Letter, and I'm so excited.
That's very exciting. We should do a Newman for the podcast at some point.
Traveler of the Century is like probably my favorite of his. I like Fracture too. Have you read that one? The one that takes place in Japan?
No.
That's nice too.
I was actually just thinking that an author, like a contemporary writer that like seems, I don't know if I really want to make, I'll make the claim, that could maybe do something similar to Walzer, David Peace. Now he writes a ton, but his, and he doesn't really write in the similar mode, but I don't know. There's something about his book, Patient X, which is all about Akutagawa. It's basically a historical biography, a literary biography of Akutagawa. Is there are things that he does in there that, I don't know, somehow are hitting a similar frequency for me as some of what Walzer's like digging into exploring in this one. What about you, Lori? Does anything specific come to mind?
I already gave mine, Buddenbrooks. Yeah, yeah. I think that's, and when I'm thinking about the other works of Thomas Mann, I don't really think it so much rings true. But yeah, Buddenbrooks definitely. Just in terms of the family element, Germany around the same period of time, or not quite the same, but maybe a couple decades earlier, but.
Yeah, I venture to also add Jesse Ball a little bit into the mix.
That's like the curfew. I think definitely.
I think similar. It's certainly not as like long winded or as dense as his work is not often as like dense as the Tanners. But I think I can absolutely see the potential influence on the miniaturism and the. Like these kind of like surreal family dynamics in a little way.
Yeah. And the sense of movement. I mean, Ball's characters are always moving and usually on foot from one place to the next. Right. And a lot of what happens in the novels happen while people are walking and thinking and exploring all that. Actually, on the miniatures point, I forget which press it is. I'll put it in the show notes if I can remember and figure it out. I don't think it's Green Integer. I think it's something really small. But Jesse Ball does lucid dreaming.
Oh, yes.
It's something he teaches all of his writing students. But he has this collection of very short pieces that I believe, if I'm remembering this correctly, are basically his journal entries from his dreams.
Is this and Sleep, so he's, Death's Brother? Or...
I don't think so. The Village on Horseback. Actually, Smokey. I was thinking.
Yeah.
Village on Horseback, prose and verse. I could absolutely see that also as being having some connective tissue.
Yeah. That early collection of Jesse Ball work is my favorite. It's my favorite like compendium of his. Like more so than his novels. Like I used to go and I used to read that like kind of once a summer where I just like kind of revisit and drop in and out of it because it's just a collection of pieces from a certain era of his writing that was then reprinted by Milkweed. But yeah, it's phenomenal, and that's absolutely where you see. Kind of, I think the strongest influence of Robert Walzer and Jesse Ball's work is in a lot of those early experimental pieces. Yeah, that's a man. I haven't thought about that book in a while. That is that book is really a trip.
Yeah, it's fun. He's good. Well, this has been really fun, Spencer. This has been really great.
Yeah, thank you both again for having me on and for indulging in my wanting to reread the Tanners after so many years. This is really wonderful.
It's been really so interesting, and for me, and I'm thinking you feel the same way, Tom, just really satisfying to talk to people that have their lives in books, surrounded by books, just talking about an older book that doesn't really get much airplay anymore. The conversations have been great.
They've been really fantastic. And it's one of the points that this podcast is why we started doing it, to talk about backlist, talk about things that we love. And it's really fantastic to bring in other folks who love books and love specific books just as much as we do. And that's been really great. So thank you so much, Spencer. This is really fun.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Tom and Lori.
Thank you.